comfort them, to tell them to take heart, that the war was almost over. Weeks left, not months now. Just hold on. Just stay alive. 3. Long after dark, on April 8, 1945, Pino and General Lyers reached the village of Molinella, northeast of Bologna. Lyers took a cot in a Wehrmacht encampment there, and Pino slept fitfully in the Fiat's front seat. By dawn they were on higher ground, west of the village of Argenta, where they could look down on the flatter, wetter terrain on both sides of the Senio River, which ran into Lake Comacchio, an estuary near the coast. The lake blocked the Allies' ability to flank around fortifications Lyers had built on the river's north side. Tank traps, minefields, trenches, pillboxes. Even from several kilometers away, Pino could see them all clearly. Beyond them, on the other side of the river in Allied territory, nothing moved beyond the odd lorry heading to or from Rimini and the Adriatic Sea. For many hours on that hill that day, there was little sound save that of spring birds and insects, and a warm breeze carried the scent of fields under plow. It all made Pino realize that the earth did not know war, that nature would go on no matter what horror one man might inflict on another. Nature didn't care a bit about men and their need to kill and conquer. The morning dragged on. The heat built. Around noon, they heard distant thuds, the echoes of explosions coming from the waters off Rimini, and soon, in the distance, Pino could see smoke rising far out to sea. He wondered what had happened. It was as if General Lyers heard him. "They're bombing our ships," he said matter-of-factly. "They're choking us off, but down there is where they'll try to break me." The afternoon ticked on, and soon it was as hot as a summer's day, but not as dry. Instead of baking heat, all the moisture that had fallen during the winter steamed from the ground, making the air thick and oppressive. Pino sat in the shade of the car, while Lyers kept up his vigil.
"What will you do after the war, Vorarbeiter?" Lyers asked at one point.
"Moi, mon général?" Pino said.
"I don't know. Maybe go back to school. Maybe work for my parents."
"And you?"
General Lyers lowered his binoculars.
"I can't see that far ahead yet."
"And Dolly?"
Lyers cocked his head, as if wondering whether to reprimand him for his impudence, but then said,
"When the Brenner opens, she'll be taken care of."
They both caught a rumbling, droning noise to the south. Lyers threw up his glasses and studied the sky.
"It begins," he said.
Pino jumped to his feet, shaded his eyes, and saw the heavy bombers coming out of the south, 10 across and 20 deep. 200 warplanes flew right at them, until they were so close, Pino began to fear they'd release their payloads over his head. A mile out and a mile up, however, they banked in formation, showing their bellies as the bomb bays opened. The lead flight of bombers dropped altitude, set their wings, and swooped above the Gothic line and German territory. They released bombs that whistled and trailed behind them, looking like so many fish diving from the sky. The first one struck well behind the German defenses and erupted, hurling debris and throwing a rainbow of fluorescence and flame. More bombs started blowing up behind the Gothic fortifications, leaving charred blast holes and copper-red fires stitched in a carpet of violence and destruction that rolled east toward the estuary and the sea. The last of the birds in the first wave were followed 10 minutes later by a second and a third and a fourth, more than 800 heavy bombers in all. The lumbering planes let loose their ordnance in that same rhythmic pattern, only off by a degree or two, so the new bombs struck in different parts of the German rear guard. Armories exploded. Petrol supplies erupted. Barracks and roads and lorries and tanks and supply dumps evaporated in the initial assault. Then medium and light bombers flew in low over the river, attacking the defensive line itself. Sections of Lyris's tank traps blew up. Pillboxes disintegrated. Cannon emplacements fell. In the course of the next 4 hours, Allied bombers dropped 20,000 bombs on the area. In the gaps between the aerial assaults, 2,000 Allied artillery pieces shelled the Gothic line in 30-minute-long barrages. When the late afternoon sun shone into the smoke plumes up and down the river, the spring sky looked hellish and low. Pino glanced at Lyers. As he scanned the battleground south of his broken defenses through the field glasses, the general's hands trembled, and he cursed in German.
"Mon général," Pino said.
"They're coming," Lyers said. "Tanks, jeeps, artillery. Entire armies are advancing on us. Our boys will hold as long as they can, and many will die for that river. But at some point, not long now, every soldier down there will be confronted with the inevitable loser's choice. Retreat, surrender, or die." As the day gave way to gathering dusk, Allied soldiers with flamethrowers invaded the German trenches and the pillboxes. A black and starless night fell. As hand-to-hand combat waged out there in the darkness, all Pino could see were explosive flashes and slow whips of fire.
"They'll be overrun by morning," Lyers said at last. "It's over."
"In Italy, we have a saying that it's not over until the fat lady sings, mon général," Pino said.
"I hate opera," the general grunted and walked toward the car.
"Get me out of here, back to Milan, before I'm caught without options."
Pino didn't know what that meant exactly, but he eagerly climbed behind the wheel. "The Nazis can retreat, surrender, or die now," he thought. "The war itself is dying. Only days now from peace and... well, Americans."
Pino drove through the night back to Milan, elated at the thought that he might at long last get to meet an American, or an entire army of them. Maybe after he and Anna were married, they'd go to the United States like his cousin Licia Albanese did, bring his mother's purses and Uncle Albert's leather goods to New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles. He would make his own fortune there. Pino felt a thrill go up his spine at that idea, and he caught a glimpse of a future unimaginable to him just a few moments before. The entire drive back, he did not once think of the biblical-scale destruction he'd just witnessed. He thought about doing something good and profitable with his life, something con smania, and he couldn't wait to tell Anna all about it.
4. The Gothic line along the Senio River was breached later that night. By the following evening, there were Allied forces from New Zealand and India nearly 5 kilometers beyond Lyers's broken defenses, with the German army retreating and reforming to the north. On April 14th, after another stunning bombardment, the U.S. 5th Army broke through the western wall of the Gothic line and rolled north toward Bologna. Every day brought news of more Allied advances. Pino listened to the BBC each night on Baca's shortwave radio. He also spent almost every day driving Lyers from battlefront to battlefront, or along the escape routes, where they watched long German columns fleeing at a much slower pace than when they'd invaded Italy.
The Nazi war machine looked crippled to Pino. He could see it in the shimmying tanks losing their treads, and the shell-shocked infantrymen walking behind teams of mules pulling cannons. Scores of German wounded lay in open lorries, exposed to the blistering hot sun. Pino hoped they'd die then and there. Every 2 or 3 days, he and Lyris would return to the Brenner Pass. With the heat had come snowmelt, and a torrent of filthy ice water ran down the pass, undermining the culverts and the road. When they reached the end of the open route, slaves were ankle and shin deep in the frigid water, still working beside the steam shovels and the dump trucks. On April 17th, the gray men were a mile from the Austrian border. One of them collapsed in the water. SS guards dragged him out and threw him to the side. General Lyers seemed not to notice.
"Work them around the clock," he told the captain in charge. "The entire Wehrmacht 10th will be coming up this road inside a week."
Chapter 27. Saturday, April 21st, 1945. 1. General Lyers stood off to one side as organization tote officers doused 5 large piles of documents with petrol in the yard outside the OT's office in Turin. Lyers nodded to one officer, who lit and flicked a stick match. There was a loud whoosh, and flames seemed to gather and plume everywhere at once. The general watched the papers burn with great interest. So did Pino. What in them was so important that Lyers would leave Dolly's bed at 3 o'clock a.m. to see them destroyed, and then to stand there, waiting to make sure they were all burned? Was there evidence in those papers that incriminated Lyers somehow? There had to be. Before Pino could begin to think about that, Lyers barked out orders at the OT officers, and then turned to look at Pino.
"Padua," he said.
Pino drove south and looped around Milan to Padua. On the way, he fought not to doze off with thoughts that the war was almost over. The Allies had broken through Lyris's defenses in the Argenta Gap. The 10th Mountain Division of the U.S. Army was closing on the Po River. Lyers seemed to sense Pino's fatigue, dug in his pockets, and came up with a vial. He spilled a small white pill in his hand and passed it to Pino.
"Take it. Amphetamine. Keep you awake. Go ahead. I use them myself."
Pino took the pill and soon felt wide awake but irritable, and his head ached when they got to Padua, where the general oversaw another mass burning of OT documents. Afterward, they drove up the Brenner Pass again. Fewer than 250 meters of snow now separated the Nazis from an open road into Austria, and Lyers was told they would break through within the next 48 hours. On Sunday morning, April 22nd, Pino watched Lyers destroy OT documents in Verona. In the afternoon, the Brescia files went up in flames. At every stop, before each burning, the general carried his valise inside the OT offices and spent time looking through files before overseeing the burns. Lyers would not let Pino touch the valise, which was getting heavier with each stop. In the early evening, he saw OT documents in Bergamo burn before they returned to Lyers's offices behind the Como Stadium. The following morning, Monday, April 23rd, General Lyers watched OT officers light a huge bonfire of files and documents on the stadium pitch. Lyers oversaw the feeding of that fire for several hours. Pino was allowed nowhere near the documents. He sat in the stands in the building heat, watching the Nazi records turn to smoke and floating ash. When they returned to Milan later that afternoon, 2 SS Panzer units had sealed off the neighborhoods around the Duomo, and even Lyers was scrutinized before being allowed inside. At the Hotel Regina, Gestapo headquarters,
Pinot found out why. Colonel Walter Ralph was drunk, in a rage, and trying to burn anything with his name on it. But when the Gestapo chief saw Liars, he brightened and invited him into his office. Liars looked at Pinot and said,
"You're done for the day, but I have a 9 a.m. meeting. Pick me up at Dolly's at 8:45.
"Oui, mon général," Pinot said.
"The car?"
"Take it with you."
2. General Liars followed Ralph inside. Pinot hated that so many documents were disappearing. The proof of what the Nazis had done to Italy was vanishing, and there seemed to be little he could do but report it to the Allies. He parked the Fiat 2 blocks from his apartment building, left his armband on the seat, swastika up, and got past the lobby sentries once more. Michele held a finger to his lips, and Aunt Greta shut the apartment door.
"Papa?" Pinot said.
"We have a visitor," his father said in a hushed tone. "My cousin's son, Mario."
Pinot squinted.
"Mario? I thought he was a fighter pilot."
"I still am,"
Mario said, stepping from the shadows. He was a short, square-shouldered man with a big smile.
"I got shot down the other night, but parachuted out and made it here."
"Mario will hide here until the war is over," Michele said.
"Your father and your aunt have been filling me in on your activities," Mario said, clapping Pinot on the back. "Takes a lot of guts."
"Oh, I don't know," Pinot said. "I think Mimo's had a tougher time of it."
"Nonsense," Aunt Greta said, before Pinot put his hands up in surrender. "I haven't had a shower in 3 days," he said. "And then I need to move the general's car. Glad you're alive, Mario."
"You too, Pinot," Mario said.
Pinot went down the hall to the bathroom near his bedroom. He stripped off his smoky clothes, then showered to get the smell off his body and out of his hair. He put on his best clothes and a little splash of his father's aftershave on his cheeks. It had been 4 days since he'd seen Anna, and he wanted to impress. In the dining room, he left a note for Baca describing the document burns, said his goodbyes to his father, aunt, and cousin, and left. Dusk was falling, but heat still radiated from the buildings and the macadam, as penetrating as any sauna. It felt good as he walked. The heat and humidity loosened his joints after days of driving and standing and watching. Climbing into the Fiat, Pinot reached to start it when someone moved in the back seat and put the cold muzzle of a pistol to the back of his head.
"Don't move," said a man. "Hands on the wheel. Gun?"
"No," Pinot said, hearing the waver in his voice.
"What do you want? What do you think?"
Pinot recognized the voice now, and he was suddenly terrified. His brains were about to be blown out.
"Don't, Mimo," he said.
"Mama and Papa."
Pinot felt the steel of the muzzle come off his head.
"Pinot, I'm so goddamn sorry about the things I said to you," Mimo began. "I know what you've been doing now, the spying, and I'm in awe of your courage, your dedication to the cause."
Emotion welled in Pinot's throat, but then he got angry.
"Then why'd you put a gun to my head?"
"I didn't know if you were armed. I thought you might try to kill me."
"I'd never shoot my baby brother."
Mimo lurched over the seat and threw his arms around Pinot.
"Do you forgive me?"
"Of course," Pinot said, letting go of the anger.
"You couldn't have known, and I wasn't allowed to tell you, because Uncle Albert said it would be safer that way."
Mimo nodded, wiped his eyes with his sleeve, and said,
"I was sent by partisan commanders who told me what you've been doing. I'm to give you your orders."
"Orders? I take my orders from General Liars."
"Not anymore," Mimo said,
handing him a piece of paper. You are to arrest Liars on the night of the 25th and bring him to that address.
Arrest General Liars? At first the idea unnerved Pino, but then he imagined himself aiming a pistol at Liars's head, and rather liked the idea. He would arrest the general, and when he did, he'd reveal himself as a spy. He'd drub that fact into the Nazi's face.
I've been right here under your nose the entire time. I've seen everything you've done, slave master.
I'll do it, Pino said at last. It will be an honor.
I'll see you when the war is over, Mimo said.
Where are you going?
Back to the fight.
How? What will you do?
Tank sabotage tonight. And we're waiting for the Nazis to start retreating from Milan. Then we're going to ambush them, teach them to never even think about coming back to Italy.
And the fascists?
Them too. We need a clean slate if we're going to start over.
Pino shook his head. Mimo was barely 16, and yet a battle-hardened veteran.
Don't get killed before it's over, Pino said.
You either, Mimo said, slipping from the car and into the shadows. Pino twisted around in his seat, trying to spot his brother leaving, but he saw nothing. It was as if Mimo were a ghost. That made Pino smile, and he started General Liars's car, feeling good about things for the first time in days, at least since he'd last seen Anna. 3. Pino's heart soared as he parked in front of Dolly's apartment around 8 that evening. Giving the old crone in the lobby a wave, he climbed the stairs to the third floor and knocked eagerly on Dolly's door. Anna answered, smiling. She pecked him on the cheek, whispered,
"Dolly's upset. The general hasn't been here in almost 4 days.
"He's coming back tonight," Pino said. "I'm sure of it."
"Please tell her that," Anna said, and shooed him down the hall.
Dolly Stottlemyre was on the couch in the living area, dressed in one of Lyris's white tunics and little else. She had whiskey neat in a tumbler with ice, and she looked like it wasn't her first or second or even fifth of the day. Seeing Pino, Dolly set her jaw for a woman scorned and said,
"Where's my Hansi?"
"The general's at Wehrmacht headquarters," Pino said.
"We were supposed to be in Innsbruck by now," Dolly said, slurring.
"The pass opens tomorrow," Pino said. "And he told me just the other day that's where he was moving you."
Tears welled up in Dolly's eyes.
"He did?"
"I heard him."
"Thank you," Dolly said, and her hand trembled as she raised her glass. "I didn't know what was to become of me."
She sipped the whiskey, smiled, and got up.
"You two go on now. I need to make myself pretty."
Dolly lurched by them and held onto the wall before disappearing down the hall. When they heard her bedroom door slam shut, they went to the kitchen. Pino spun Anna around, picked her up, and kissed her. Anna threw her legs around him and kissed him back with equal ardor. When at last their lips separated, she said,
"I have food for you. The sausage and broccoli dish you like, and bread and butter."
Pino realized he was starved, put her down reluctantly, and said quietly,
"God, I've missed you. You can't know how good it is to be here with you right now."
Anna beamed at him.
"I didn't know it could be like this."
"I didn't either," Pino said, and kissed her again and again. They ate hot sausages and broccoli sautéed in garlic and olive oil, along with bread and butter, and drank more of the general's wine before slipping off to Anna's room after hearing the knock at the front door and Dolly's cry of not to worry that she would get it. In the heat, in her small room in the dark, Anna's scent was everywhere around him, and he was instantly drunk on it. He peered for her shape in the pitch black, heard her bed springs creak, and went to her. When he lay by her side and reached out to find her body, Anna was already naked and wanting him. 4. There was a knock, and then another at the maid's door. Pino startled awake the morning of April 24th, 1945, and looked around in confusion as Anna roused on his chest and called,
"Yes?"
Dolly said,
"It's 7:40. The general needs his driver in 20 minutes, and we are to pack, Anna. The Brenner is clear."
"We leave today?" Anna said.
"As soon as possible," Dolly replied.
They lay there waiting for Dolly's heels to clip down the hall to the kitchen. Pino kissed Anna tenderly and said, "That was the most amazing night of my life."
"Mine too," she said,
staring into his eyes as if they held dreams.
"I'll never forget how magical it was."
"Never, ever." They kissed again, their lips barely touching. She inhaled when he exhaled, and exhaled when he inhaled, and Pino felt once again how like a single creature they were when they were like this, together.
"How will I find you?" Pino said.
"In Innsbruck, I mean."
"I'll call your parents' apartment once we get there."
"Why don't you just go to my parents' apartment now? Or at least once you've got Dolly packed."
"Dolly needs me to get settled," Anna said. "She knows I want to come straight back to Milan as soon as possible."
"Does she?"
"Yes.
I told her she was going to have to hire a new maid." Pino kissed her, and they untangled and dressed. Before he went out the door, he took Anna in his arms and said, "I don't know when I'll see you again."
"You'll hear from me, I promise. I'll call for you as soon as I can."
Pino gazed into Anna's eyes, stroked his powerful hands over her face, and murmured, "The war's all but over. Will you marry me when you come back?"
"Marry?"
she said, tears glistening in her eyes.
"You're sure?"
"More than sure." Anna kissed his palm and whispered,
"Then yes."
Pino felt joy surge through him, as powerful as a crescendo.
"Yes?" "Of course. With all my heart, Pino. With all my soul."
"I know it's corny," Pino said, "but you've just made me the happiest, luckiest guy in all of Italy."
"I think we've made each other happy and lucky," she said, kissing him again.
Hearing the general's boots in the kitchen already, Pino held her as long as he dared and whispered,
"Our love will be eternal." "Forever and ever," she said.
They parted. Pino took one last look at Anna, winked, and left with her beauty, her scent, and her touch dominating his mind. 5. General Liers went first to Gestapo headquarters, emerging from the Hotel Regina an hour later. Then they drove to the telephone exchange, where Liers disappeared inside for hours, while another day of listless heat baked Milan. Pino took refuge in the shade and noticed that everyone who walked by seemed on edge, as if they'd sensed a violent storm coming. He thought of Anna. When would he see her again? He felt hollow at the thought it might be a week or a month. But what was time after the war? Infinite. And Anna said yes to his sudden proposal. She would love him forever and ever. And he would love her forever and ever.
No matter what might happen, something was certain about his future now, and it calmed him.
Let not your heart be troubled, Pino thought, and basked in the sureness of being part of something bigger than himself, eternal. He was already envisioning a fantastic life for them, already falling in love with the miracles of what tomorrow might hold.
He needed a ring, didn't he? He could... Pino realized that he was just a few blocks from the Piazzale Loreto and Beltramini's fresh fruits and vegetables. Was Carletto there? How was his mother? He hadn't seen his oldest friend in more than 8 months, since he'd stumbled away from Carletto as he held his poor father's dead body. Part of Pino wanted to walk there from the telephone exchange and explain himself, but the fear that Carletto might not believe him kept him put, sweating, hungry, and sick of waiting around on the general's whim. He would have Mimmo go tell Carletto when the time was...
Vorarbeiter!
General Lyers barked. Pino jumped up, saluting, and running toward the general, who was already at the back door of the Fiat, holding his valise, an impatient, annoyed look on his face. Pino apologized, blaming it on the heat. Lyers looked up at the sky and the sun beating down on the city.
Does it always get like this in late April?
No, mon général, Pino said, relieved as he opened the door.
It's very rare. Everything about the weather this year is very rare. Where do we go?
Como? Lyers said. We'll be spending the night.
Oui, mon général, Pino said, glancing in the rear view, where Lyers was rifling around his valise.
And when will Dolly and Anna go to Innsbruck? The general looked engrossed in something, didn't look up.
They're on their way by now, I should think. No more questions. I have work to do.
Pino drove to Como and the stadium. 3 days before, he'd seen the bonfire on the pitch. The ash was gone, and there were several companies of Organization Tote soldiers and officers encamped on the field. They'd put up tarps over sections of the grandstands and lounged under them in the shade, as if they were on holiday. When Lyers went inside, Pino curled up in the front seat of the Fiat. But by the raucous noise echoing from the stadium, he figured the German soldiers were drinking. Lyers was probably in there with them. They lost, but the war was over, or would be any day now. That was cause enough for any man to get drunk, he supposed, and fell into a deep sleep. 6. Pino woke the next morning, Wednesday, April 25th, 1945, to the sound of knuckles rapping against the Fiat's passenger window. He was surprised the sun had risen. He'd slept soundly, dreamed of Anna, and... The car door opened. An OT soldier said General Lyers needed him inside. Pino got up, ran his fingers through his hair, looked at himself in the mirror. Grimy, but okay. He followed the soldier inside Lyers' headquarters and down a series of halls to a room with a glass window that overlooked the pitch. The general was dressed in civilian clothes and drinking coffee with a short man with jet black hair and a narrow black mustache. He turned to look at Pino and nodded.
You prefer English or Italian?
The man said in an American accent. Pino, who towered over him, said, English is fine.
Max Corvo, he said, and stuck out his hand.
Pino hesitated, but then shook it.
Pino Lella, where are you from?
America, Connecticut. Tell the general that I'm here with the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, and that I represent Alan Dulles.
Pino hesitated, but then translated it into French for the general, who nodded.
Corvo said, We want your assurance that your men will remain in their barracks, General Lyers, and offer zero resistance if they are asked to lay down their arms.
Pino translated. Lyers nodded.
When there's a deal in place, signed by Field Marshal Fietinghoff, my men will comply. And tell him I continue to work to save Milan from destruction.
The United States of America appreciates that, General Liars, Corvo said. I think there'll be something on paper and signed in less than a week, maybe even sooner.
Liars nodded. Until then, wish Mr. Dulles my best.
Pino translated, and then added, He has been burning documents across northern Italy for the past 3 days.
Corvo cocked his head.
That true?
Yes, Pino said. They're all burning documents. All of them.
Okay, the OSS agent said. Thanks for telling me.
Corvo shook the general's hand and Pino's, and then he was gone. Pino stood there for several awkward moments before Liars said,
What were you saying there just before he left?
I asked him what Connecticut was like, and he said it was nowhere as beautiful as Italy.
The general studied him.
Let's go. I have an appointment with Cardinal Schuster.
7.
When they drove back into the city at 2 that afternoon, Milan felt electric and rebellious. Factory whistles were blowing. Conductors and drivers were walking away from the remaining trolley cars and buses, creating havoc for the German convoys trying to forge through the city on their way north. When Pino was stopped at a crossing, he swore he heard the crackle of rifle fire in the distance. That caused him to glance at General Liars in the back seat and think about the satisfaction he'd take in arresting the Nazi and telling him he'd been a spy all along.
Where should I do it? And how? In the car? Or on the road somewhere?
The closer they got to the Duomo, the more Nazis they saw. Most were Waffen-SS, the killers, the rapists, the plunderers, and the slave guards. They were in the streets all around Gestapo headquarters, taking refuge behind the Panzer tanks in and around the cathedral and the chancellery, where Pino parked outside the gates, because there were too many cars in the courtyard already. Pino followed Liars toward the stairs. A priest intercepted them.
His Eminence is seeing you in his office today, General.
When they entered Schuster's ornate formal offices, the Cardinal of Milan sat behind his desk like a judge wearing white robes, his red mitre on the shelf behind him. Pino took in the crowded room. Giovanni Barbareschi, the seminarian, stood off the Cardinal's left shoulder. Nearest to them was Eugen Dolman, Hitler's Italian translator. Beside Dolman stood SS General Wolf and several men in business suits Pino did not know. Seated at the far left side of the cardinal's desk, balancing on a cane, was an angry old man whom Pino would not have recognized had his mistress not been sitting next to him. Benito Mussolini looked twisted inside and out, like a spring that had been overwound and sprung. His skin pale and sweaty, the puppet dictator had lost weight and was hunched forward as if against stomach pain. Claretta Petacci stroked Il Duce's hand idly and leaned against him for comfort. Behind Mussolini and his mistress, there were two men wearing red neckerchiefs. Partisan leaders, Pino thought.
Everyone you asked to be here is here, Your Eminence, Barbareschi said.
Schuster eyed them all.
Nothing said here leaves this room. Are we in accord?
One by one they all nodded, including Pino, who wondered why he was even in the room with Dolman there to translate.
Our goal, then, is to save Milan further suffering and limit the amount of German blood spilled as they retreat. Yes?
Mussolini nodded. After Dolman translated, Wolf and Liars did too.
Good, the cardinal said. General Wolf, what can you report? I've been to Lugano twice in the past few days, the SS general said. Negotiations are moving slower than expected, but moving. We are 3, maybe 4 days away from having a document to sign.
Mussolini came up out of a stupor.
What document? What negotiations?
Wolf glanced at the cardinal, then at General Liers, who said,
Duce, the war is lost. Hitler has gone mad in his bunker. We have all been working to end the conflict with as little death and destruction as possible.
Sitting there, hunched over his cane, Mussolini went from ashen to beet red. Little bubbles of spittle showed at the corners of Il Duce's lips, which squirmed before he thrust out his chiseled jaw and began shouting and waving his cane at Wolf and Liers.
You Nazi bastards! Mussolini roared. Once more we can say that Germany has knifed Italy in the back. I'll go on the radio. I'll tell the world of your treachery.
You'll do no such thing, Benito, Cardinal Schuster said.
Benito?
Mussolini cried with indignation.
Cardinal Schuster, you will address me as Excellency.
The Cardinal took a long breath and then bowed his head.
Excellency, it is important to reach an agreement of surrender before the masses rise up and revolt. If not, we will have anarchy, which I intend to prevent. If you are not committed to that goal, Duce, I'll have to ask you to leave.
Mussolini looked around the room, shook his head in disgust, and put his hand out to his mistress.
Like how they treat us, Clara? We're on our own now.
Petacci took the fascist leader's hand and said,
I'm ready, Duce.
They labored to their feet and started toward the door.
Excellency, Cardinal Schuster called after him. Wait.
The prelate went to his shelves, pulled down a book, and handed it to Mussolini. It's a history of Saint Benedict. Repent your sins, and you may find comfort in this book, in the sad days that are now on your horizon. Mussolini got a sour look about him, but took the book and handed it to his mistress. On the way out, he said,
I should have them all shot.
8. The door slammed shut behind them.
Shall we proceed? Cardinal Schuster said.
General Wolf, has the German High Command agreed to my request?
Fietinghoff wrote me this morning. He has given orders for his men to stand down from offensive actions, to remain in barracks until they are contacted.
Not quite a surrender, but a start, said Cardinal Schuster.
And there's still a core group of SS here in the streets around the Duomo. They're loyal to Colonel Ralph?
I would think so, Wolf said.
But Ralph answers to you, Schuster said.
At times.
Issue him an order, then. Forbid him and those monsters in uniform from perpetrating any more atrocities before they leave this country.
Atrocities, Wolf said.
I don't know what you're...
Don't insult me, the Cardinal of Milan snapped. You will not be able to cover up the things done in Italy and to Italians, but you can prevent further massacres from happening.
Are we in agreement?
Wolf looked highly agitated, but nodded.
I'll write the orders now.
Barbareschi said,
I'll deliver them for you.
Cardinal Schuster looked at the seminarian.
Are you sure?
I want to look the man who tortured me in the eye as he gets the news. Wolf scribbled the order on stationery, sealed it with Schuster's wax, and put his ring into the wax before handing it to the seminarian. As Barbareschi was leaving, the priest who'd let them in returned and said,
Cardinal Schuster, the prisoners of San Vittore are rioting!
Chapter 28 1 They were at the Chancellery until dusk. General Wolf left. General Lyers and Cardinal Schuster discussed ways for the Germans and the resistance to trade prisoners. It was only outside with the setting of the sun that Pino remembered again that he was charged with taking Lyers prisoner before midnight. He wished the partisans had given him specific instructions beyond an address where he was to take the general. Then again, they'd given him responsibility, a task, just like they'd given Mimo the task of sabotaging tanks. The details were his to work out. But as he reached the staff car, Pino was still trying to decide how best to arrest the general, given that he always sat directly behind him in the back seat. Opening the rear door to the Fiat, Pino saw Lyris's valise there and cursed to himself. It had been there the entire time they'd been inside. He could have excused himself and spent time looking at the files in that valise, probably the ones Lyers had saved from the fires. General Lyers climbed in without glancing his way and said, "The Hotel Regina." Pino thought about pulling his Walther and putting Lyers under arrest right then and there, but, unsure of himself, he shut the door and got behind the wheel. Due to all the German vehicles jamming the narrow streets, he had to take a convoluted route to Gestapo headquarters. Near Piazza San Babila, he saw a German lorry filled with armed soldiers stop at the exit to a parking garage a half block away. Someone was standing in the street, aiming a machine pistol at the windshield of the Nazi lorry. Pino was stunned when the gunman turned. "Mimo," he gasped, slamming on the brakes.
"Vorarbeiter," General Lyers said.
Pino ignored him and climbed out. He was no more than 100 meters from his brother, who was waving his gun at the Germans and shouting,
"All you Nazi swine, lay down your weapons, drop them out of the lorry, and then all of you face down on the sidewalk there."
The next second seemed like an eternity. When no Germans moved, Mimo touched off a burst of fire. Lead bullets pinged off the side of the parking garage. In the ringing silence that followed, the Germans in the back of the lorry began to throw down their guns.
"Vorarbeiter,"
Lyers said, and Pino was surprised to find he'd gotten out of the car as well, and was watching the scene over his shoulder.
"Forget the Hotel Regina. Take me to Dolly's instead. I just realized I left some important papers there, and I want to..."
Emboldened by Mimo, and without a thought, Pino drew his pistol, spun around, and stuck it into Lyers's gut. He enjoyed the look of shock in the general's eye.
"What is this, Vorarbeiter?" Lyers said.
"Your arrest, mon général," Pino said.
"Vorarbeiter Lella," he said firmly. "You will remove that weapon, and we will forget this happened. You will drive me to Dolly's. I will get my papers, and..."
"I won't drive you anywhere, slave master!"
The general took that like a slap to the face. His expression twisted with rage.
"How dare you address me like this? I could have you shot for treason!"
"I'll take treason against you and Hitler any day," Pino said, equally angry. "Turn around and hands behind your head, mon général, or I will shoot you in the knees."
Lyers sputtered, but saw Pino was serious and did as he was told. Pino reached around and took the pistol Lyers carried when he was in business clothes. He pocketed it, waved the Walther, and said,
"Get in."
Lyers moved toward the rear, but Pino shoved him instead into the driver's seat. With his gun aimed at General Lyers's head, Pino climbed into the back seat and shut the door. He put his forearm on the valise, as Lyers often did, and smiled, liking this role reversal, feeling like he'd earned it, that now, at last, there would be justice done.
He looked past Liars through the windshield. His brother had 20 Nazi soldiers on their bellies, hands behind their heads. Mimo was unloading and stacking their weapons on the opposite sidewalk.
"It doesn't have to be like this, Vorarbeiter," Liars said. "I have money, lots of it."
"German money?" Pino snorted. "It will be worthless if it isn't already. Turn the car around now, and as you have told me so often, don't talk unless you're spoken to."
The general paused, but then started the car and did a 3-point turn. When he did, Pino rolled down the back window, yelling,
"I'll see you at home, Mimo!"
His brother looked up in wonder, realized who was yelling at him, and threw his fist over his head.
"Uprising, Pino!" Mimo shouted. "Uprising!"
2. Pino felt chills go through him as Liars drove them out of San Babila and toward the address Mimo had passed along from the partisan commanders. He had no idea why he was supposed to bring Liars to that specific address, and he didn't care. He was no longer in the shadows. He was no longer a spy. He was part of the rebellion now, and it made him feel righteous as he barked directions and turns at the general, who drove stoop-shouldered. 10 minutes into the ride, Liars said,
"I have more than German money."
"I don't care," Pino said.
"I have gold. We can go and..."
Pino poked Liars' head with the pistol barrel. "I know you have gold. Gold you stole from Italy. Gold you murdered 4 of your slaves over, and I don't want it."
"Murdered?" Liars said.
"No, Vorarbeiter, that's not... I hope you face a firing squad for what you've done."
General Liars stiffened.
"You can't mean that."
"Shut up.
I don't want to hear another word." Liars seemed resigned to his fate then, and drove sullenly through the city, as Pino entertained a voice in his head that said, "Don't miss your chance. Exact some punishment. Have him pull over. Shoot him in the leg, at least. Let him go to his fate wounded and in agony." Isn't that the way you're supposed to enter hell?
The general rolled down his window at one point, and put his head out as if to smell his last moments of freedom. But when they rolled up to the gate at the address on Via Bronni, Liars stared straight ahead. A gunman wearing a red scarf came out the gate. Pino told him he'd been ordered to arrest the general and was there to turn him over. "We've been waiting," the guard said, and called for the gate to be opened. Liars drove into a compound and parked. He opened the door and tried to get out. Another partisan grabbed him, spun him around, and handcuffed him. The first gunman took the valise. Liars looked back at Pino with disgust, but said nothing before he was dragged off through a door. It slammed shut behind him, and Pino realized he'd never told the general he was a spy.
"What happens to him?" Pino asked.
"He'll go on trial, probably be hanged," the guard with the valise said. Pino felt acid in his throat as he said, "I want to testify against him."
"I'm sure you'll get your chance. Car keys?"
Pino handed them over.
"What do I do?"
"Go home. Here, take this letter. Show it to any partisan who might stop you." Pino took the letter, folded it, and put it in his pocket.
"Can I get a ride?"
"Sorry," he said. "You'll have to walk. Don't worry, in 10 or 20 minutes, it won't be hard to see at all."
"Do you know my brother, Mimo Lella?" Pino asked.
The guard laughed. "We all know that terror, and we're happy he's on our side." 3. Despite their praise for Mimo, Pino walked to the gate feeling let down and cheated somehow.
Why hadn't he told Liars he was a spy? Why hadn't he asked what he was burning in those files? What was it? Evidence of slavery? And what were those papers he wanted to retrieve from Dolly's apartment? Did the papers matter? The partisans had the valise and at least some of the files Liars had saved from the bonfires. And Pino would testify against him, tell the world what he'd seen General Liars do. When he exited the gate, Pino was on the southeast side of Milan, in one of the most heavily bombed neighborhoods. In the darkness, he kicked things and stumbled, and worried about falling into some crater in the wasteland before he could find his way home. A rifle shot rang out, not far away. And then another, followed by a burst of automatic gunfire and a grenade explosion. Pino crouched, feeling like he'd walked into a trap. He was about to turn around, try to find another way home, when in the distance he heard the Duomo's smaller bells start to peal. Then the cathedral's big bells and carillon joined, donging and tolling in the darkness. Pino felt summoned, pulled toward the basilica. He got up and started toward the bells and the Duomo, not caring about the rifle shots that crackled in the streets around him. Other church bells began to peal, and soon it all sounded like Easter morning. Then, without warning, and for the first time in nearly 2 years, street lamps all around Milan flickered on and brightened, banishing the night and the city's long misery in the shadows of war. Pino blinked at how bright the lamps were, and how they made Milan's ruins and scars stand out scorched and livid. But the lights were on, and the bells were ringing. Pino felt an enormous sense of relief. Was this it? Was it over? All those German units agreed not to fight, correct? But the soldiers Mimo arrested had not laid down their guns without threat. Gunfire and explosions went off to the northeast, toward the central train station and the Piccolo Theater, fascist headquarters. He realized partisans and fascists must be fighting for control of Milan. It was a civil war. Or perhaps there were Germans there as well, and it was a three-way battle. In any case, Pino went west, looping toward the Duomo, away from the fighting. On street after street, the people of Milan were tearing down blackout curtains in the buildings that survived and letting more light flood out into the city. Whole families hung out their windows, cheering and calling for the Nazis to be driven into the sea. Many others were out in the streets, looking up at the lights as if they were a fantasy come true. The elation was short-lived. Machine gun fire erupted from 10 different directions. Pino could hear its rattle and pause near and far. He recalled the battle that had raged around the cemetery where Gabriella Rocca lay. The war isn't over, he realized. Neither is the insurrection. The pacts made in Cardinal Schuster's office were falling apart. By the pace of the fighting, Pino soon believed he was absolutely hearing three-way combat. Partisans versus Nazis, and partisans against the fascists. When a grenade exploded in one of the adjacent streets, people began to scatter and run back into their homes. Pino bolted into an erratic, zigzagging run. When he reached Piazza Duomo, 6 German Panzer tanks still squatted around the perimeter of the square, their cannon barrels aiming outward. The cathedral's floodlights were still on, illuminating the entire church, and the bells were still tolling, but otherwise the piazza was deserted. Pino swallowed and moved fast and diagonally across the open ground, praying no snipers were waiting on the upper floors of the buildings that framed the square. 4. He reached the corner of the cathedral without incident and walked on in the shadow of the great church, looking up and seeing how soot from the years of bombardment and fire had darkened the pale pink marble facade.
Pino wondered if the stains of war would ever leave Milan. He thought of Anna then, and wondered whether she was settled into Dolly's new place.